KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Visionary inventor Buckminster Fuller never lived in the Bay Area, but evidence of his influence can be found in many innovative, environmentally conscious projects here. The San Francisco Museum of Modern Art's new architecture and design exhibition, The Utopian Impulse, Buckminster Fuller and the Bay Area, explores Fuller's work as well as a diverse set of local projects that drew inspiration from it. We discuss Buckminster Fuller and the SF MoMA exhibit after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. Our Buckminster Fuller was an inventor, an architect, an industrial designer, as well as an ecologist, a futurist, and a radical idealist visionary.
It is highly feasible. This is the real news of our century. It is highly feasible to take care of all of humanity at a higher standard of living than anybody has ever experienced or dreamt of, to do so without having anybody profit at the expense of another, so everybody can enjoy the whole Earth.
Known mostly for the geodesic domes he designed and his concept of spaceship Earth, he was someone who always seemed to be thinking outside of the proverbial box. He had influence in many areas of innovation, as well as being a major source of influence here in the Bay Area, despite the fact that he never lived here. Now, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art presents, through July 29th, The Utopian Impulse, Buckminster Fuller and the Bay Area. It's an exhibition of 65 works of Fuller's, including prints, drawings, photos, documentary, videos, and all of this from which we just heard the recording of Fuller's voice, books and models. And in this hour, we talk about the exhibit and the impact and legacy of, as he was well known to most, Bucky Fuller. With us in the studio is Sam Green. He is a filmmaker. His film, The Love Song of Our Buckminster Fuller, is playing as part of the San Francisco MoMA exhibit on Buckminster Fuller. Welcome.
Thanks.
Good to have you
here.
Good to have you. And also good to have Jennifer Fletcher, who is Assistant Curator of Architecture and Design and Acting Head of the Department of the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, curated The Utopian Impulse, Buckminster Fuller in the Bay Area. Welcome.
Thank you.
And let's start with you, Jennifer Fletcher. The museum got a gift. That was partially behind, I think, what set things off, wasn't it?
Yes. It was a gift of a portfolio called 12 Around 1 that featured 13 of his sort of most important projects. And what became, it became the start of the show, because I realized that it was better to look at it as one work and instead of 13 individual projects, one sort of life work. And this was the start of this call for a revolution in design.
Well, these were also patents to be marketed to art collectors, weren't they?
That's right. I think Fuller always thought quite large, and I think he imagined a lot of these projects might go on a massive scale.
Let's talk about some of them in that portfolio. You got a 4D house. That's one of the best known, I suppose, and one of the oldest, yeah.
Yes, yes. A house that could be easily put up, put down, taken wherever you need to go.
So it was four-dimensional.
Yes.
And then we have a motor vehicle called the Dymaxion car. He did this with Chuck Burns. He did a lot of things with co-inventing with Chuck Burns. What was that?
Actually, just to clarify, he didn't co-invent with Chuck Burns. Chuck Burns worked on the portfolio presentation of this.
I thought he was a co-inventor. I'm sorry.
No. These were all Fuller ideas, and the presentation of the portfolio was with graphic designer Chuck Burns.
So let's talk about this car. I think Stephen Wynn said it was maybe a early Prius or something.
Yeah, I'd like to invite Sam to talk about the car. He talked about it a lot in last night's performance.
The car is fantastic looking. It was sort of a Prius and an SUV together. It got 30 miles per gallon, and it seated 11 people. And this was in 1933. It just looked great. It was out of, like, Buck Rogers or something.
A lot of stuff out of
like
Buck Rogers with Buck Fuller. What is Dymaxion? What's the etymology of that?
Dymaxion was a word that Buckminster Fuller got from an advertising guy early on, and it's a combination of dynamic, maximum, and tension.
And there was an Air Ocean world map that had that name, too.
Yeah. Almost everything was the Dymaxion house, the Dymaxion car. It was his word. He was a great namer of things.
Yeah, he had a very unique language.
Well, there was tensegrity, right?
Tensegrity, synergetics.
Tension and integrity and synergetics and had his own lexicon. Boy, you go into this exhibit and right away there's 42 hours of everything I know. There's Bucky Fuller talking maybe nonstop for 2 weeks, so it would seem. And all this on YouTube, Sam?
Yeah. So he gave a lecture series in the mid-70s called Everything I Know. And it was 42 hours long, and he didn't use any notes. And it was videotaped. And, yes, somebody uploaded 5,000 little segments. It's on YouTube if you want to see it.
This is a polymath. This is a genius by any accounts and an extraordinary inventor. But you really are keying in, Jennifer Fletcher, on the Bay Area and the influence on the Bay Area.
Yes. His look at design and how design could kind of affect a massive change or the idea that design could solve solutions, I think that resonated with a lot of the Bay Area design projects. So I selected 12 projects, 6 from the 70s and 6 from the last decade.
Talk about some of those. I mean, we go back to the Whole Earth Catalog, Stuart Brand.
The Whole Earth Catalog with Stuart Brand. The very first issue was really sort of dedicated to Fuller, and then there were, 3 years worth of, I think there were about 4 issues every year. And there was a slight move away from Fuller by the end, but it has this kind of proposal for the future and an alternative future from existing governments, authority figures. And it's sort of a pre-internet. I like the very subjective voice of the recommendations within the...
This is just a date of 68 to 71, that period,
72.
Right?
72.
72. Yeah. And then you get up to the Ant Farm in 1976, yeah.
Yes, Ant Farm was from 68 to 78, but the project that's featured in the exhibition is called Convention City, and it was a proposal for a city that was dedicated to debate, of political debate. And so there were actors, the residents of the city were actors on this voting chamber and arena, and then the all of these actions were then projected to every TV in America. And one could vote instantly just from sitting on their couch. Yeah,
that's in the model. Yeah.
That's in the model.
And Sam, you've got, talk about the Bay Area influence in terms of what you wanted to get on film here.
Well, I made an installation for the exhibit, and it's called Buckminster Fuller in the Bay Area, A Relationship in 11 Fragments. And so it's 11 different vignettes, connections he had to the Bay Area, some big, some small. And I like teasing out something, a relationship like that, in these little bits and pieces. And so one of them, for example, is he was lifelong friends with Ruth Asawa, the great local artist. And at one point she made a plaster cast or a bronze cast of his hands. And they're fantastic. And her daughter, her family has those hands. And so one little piece is just about those hands, which are a wonderful artifact and they're neat to see. And so that's the piece. It's these small different little relationship fragments.
Would big things include like the federal building?
Big things are more like his idea for a floating tetrahedral city.
Oh, that's in Japan, right?
But he proposed one for the Bay.
For the Bay. Oh, yeah.
It was going to be 300,000 apartments and 1 million people right in the middle of the Bay.
And you see that, actually, and you go to the exhibit. It's really
It was
something.
On top of Alcatraz.
I mean, in fact, even more recently, when you think about the influence of Bucky Fuller, we had the Plasticky people here. I always think of the name Rothschild because he was the leader of that 12,500 plastic water bottles sailing off to Australia. Again, really influenced by Fuller, Jennifer.
Well, yes, I think for me the connection there to Fuller was the performative aspect of it. There was something about Fuller that with his kind of marathon lectures that would go anywhere from 2 hours to 12 hours, and with this larger message behind it, I thought that was something that David de Rothschild shares with Fuller.
So these are direct influences, or in some instances, maybe kind of. I mean, like Jerry Brown, now serving as governor once again, was directly and very, I think, formerly influenced by Bucky Fuller.
Yeah. Some of the projects are directly influenced, and others are much less direct.
a little bit why they called him Governor Moonbeam, in fact. Maybe the Bucky Fuller influence. But you just see so much in this exhibit. You got some stuff from the Stanford exhibit archive, too, didn't you?
Yes, a lot of it comes from the Fuller archives at Stanford, the Herbert Matter archives at Stanford, also the Whole Earth Catalog archives are at Stanford. Sam went so far as to go to Stanford's their own
their storage
unit
in Livermore. Yeah,
but you also used his self-curated material for the most part,
didn't
you?
Yeah. Which is a fascinating collection.
Talk about it, because I know there's again the Bucky Fuller language. It sounds like something out of Buck Rogers' Maximum Chronophile or whatever.
It's called the Dymaxion Chronophile, and he. Some people say that was his most impressive work in a way. I mean, I don't know if I agree with that, but it is amazing, and that's his archive. Every day of his life, from the mid-20s, he opened a file and saved things, and he saved everything. And his idea was to document one person's life. He was this test subject. And so it's phenomenally interesting. There's enormous amounts of stuff, and a lot of it are hotel bills or dry cleaning bills, but there's all his correspondence and...
How postmodern is that, by the way, documenting your own life?
There's a project, I think it's called Life Bits, this idea of documenting everything, and that's sort of the modern high-tech equivalent of what he was doing.
Actually, this is from Sam Green's film. Let's hear this clip.
Fuller hoped to document his entire life and to create a file of the chronology of his being. Grandiose? Maybe. Sure makes for good reading now.
It was all the correspondence that touched his desk, all the correspondence that he sent out, receipts, bills, letters from people, photographs. There were old film reels that hadn't been opened. It was really a very comprehensive record of, you know, all the ephemera, if you will, that would cross a person's desk in a day. And he filed that in chronological order right up until the time of his death in 1983.
There it is. That's right from the film. And actually, there are two films that you made for this project.
Yeah. One is an installation that's at the museum, and it'll be up through the summer. And that's called Buckminster Fuller in the Bay Area, A Relationship in 11 Fragments. And then I also did a live film performance about Buckminster Fuller. That was last night.
The love song of our Buckminster Fuller.
And that was with the band Yola Tango. So we did that a one-time thing last night.
Who have been on the show and who are great.
Yeah.
Makes, of course, one think of T.S. Eliot, but you're not. Are you sort of thinking about that character, Proof Rock, with Bucky Fuller? How so?
A little bit. It's more just the sound of the title I liked, and it's not a direct allusion to that necessarily.
No, because he was a meek man. He couldn't sing his love song to the women. You know,
Buckminster Fuller could.
Yes, yeah. Buckminster Fuller definitely could. And then there's that... Undersea Island. I mean, there's just so much in this exhibit to talk about. Jennifer Fletcher, talk about that, though.
The Undersea Island was actually tied with this floating tetrahedral city, which is imagined, I think, to house 100,000 residents and float from port to port around the globe.
A moving, condos moving.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
On the ocean.
Exactly.
They didn't know about Somali pirates at the time or anything like that, but boy. There's what do you want people to come away with, each of you? I mean, from the film, Sam, what do you want people to learn about Bucky Fuller particularly?
Well, I think, to me, he's a very interesting person and character, and there's also his ideas. And I think people usually relate to other people first as a character, and then they get interested in their ideas. So I'm interested in using who he was and him as a compelling figure to sort of lead people to his ideas, because ultimately I think his ideas in some ways are more relevant now than they've ever been.
It's all technology, sustainability, social responsibility, ecology. I mean, so much of what we've seen in Northern California is zeitgeist for the last...
He was saying that's from the 20s to the 80s, and in many ways... Who needed that then? But now we really do need those ideas. Yeah. So,
and you want them to see him as the visionary, don't you, Jennifer?
That's right. That's right. And less as a designer and more as a kind of a provoker of design. And also, I think there was a question that I asked within the exhibition is whether or not he's an interesting foundation, as I think. A thinker for a lot of Bay Area projects, that there is this strain of idealism that seems to be inherent to the Bay Area.
Talk about the one laptop per child exhibit, because particularly when one thinks of Silicon Valley and all that's gone on with computers and connectedness, that's a project ahead of its time.
Well, I was interested that Fuller had said, you know, if only everyone had access to information in real time, then all of, you know, the world's resource issues could be solved. And I think that, you know, Nicholas Negroponte, who is a professor at MIT, had an interest in kind of, I guess, answering a slightly different question of what if you give access to people who don't have any access at all to education, to information, and that he came to the Bay Area and enlisted Yves Behar at Fuse Project and said, how can we design something that would provide access to people who don't have any, you know, kind of resources, and let's see what happens. And what I wanted to do with the exhibition is just check in on this project. I think you won't know kind of the results of it for quite some time, but just see 5 years after it's been introduced, let's see what's happening with it.
And can you talk about the World Game Project?
The World Game Project, I think, was something that's still ongoing.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people still doing it. But the idea of having a discussion with people from different specialties and throwing questions out there and then, you know, seeing what each person brings to the kind of chalkboard of how can we solve these big problems.
The big problems leads us, Sam Green, back to Bucky Fuller thinking, well, there was a way to end world poverty.
Yeah. He thought, he believed in a design revolution and the idea of doing more with less, and that if people used resources more efficiently, there would be enough to go around for everybody. And if people weren't fighting over resources, there'd be no more war. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we haven't achieved that yet, but it's a noble goal. And in some ways, it's a very common sense. It's not pie-in-the-sky idealism.
I'm going to open the phone lines. Listeners who remember Buckminster Fuller, remember some of the things that he's remembered for, or certainly are welcome to join us with any questions you have about this exhibit or about the film Sam Green's done, but particularly like to hear from those of you who want to address the legacy of Buckminster Fuller and what you remember of Buckminster Fuller, either as a man or in terms of the work, the visionary work, well, the design work, the ecology work. I mean, it covers, like I say, it's a polymath, large canvas. Our toll-free number is available, and it's 866-733-6786. We do welcome your calls and your participation in this program, and you can join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, and we welcome your communications by email as well, forum@kqed.org. Other ways to communicate with us, go to our website, kqed.org/forum, click on this segment, or go to our Facebook page. I suppose the way to characterize Bucky Fuller, particularly for the younger generation who are not familiar with him, we have many of those, he was a dreamer.
Very much so. And as Sam said in his performance last night, a utopian, you know,
and we've got utopian in the title of this exhibit, appropriately enough, the utopian impulse. Why the impulse?
Whether or not it's realized, I think, was important to me. But just to have this kind of drive for striving towards a utopia.
And what did you come away with, Sam, in terms of his influence here in the Bay Area? Because it's Buckminster Fuller in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, it's fascinating. I mean, on one hand, he never lived here and he never built anything here, but his ideas resonated here maybe more than anywhere else. And there's an academic at Stanford named Fred Turner who wrote a great book about Fuller's influence on the counterculture and how that sort of bubbled up into early Silicon Valley and computer culture. And you really can trace a through line there through Stuart Brand, but one can see his ideas about technology and about social change percolating up through the counterculture and into a lot of the internet culture and Google and much of what we know in terms of online stuff today. And it's fascinating. That, I think, is a unique influence on the Bay Area.
He's really a Bay Area pioneer, isn't he? I mean, despite the fact that he never resided here.
Oddly enough, yeah, for sure.
And someone who is often given a great deal of credit for a lot of these ideas. What about politically? What do we know about Fuller politically? He was certainly kind of a lefty, I suppose, wasn't he?
He was kind of a lefty. He's odd. He was a unique individual in this way as well. I mean, he didn't believe in politics and he didn't believe in political change. He believed in change through design.
And he had humanity this, change.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he had this great thing about if you took all the engineers and scientists and sent them up on a spaceship, within a week we'd all die of starvation. But if you took all the politicians, sent them up on a spaceship, we'd be fine. So I think that sort of summed up his opinion of
that's
politicians.
A nice way of crystallizing his view, his worldview. What about spaceship Earth? You know, again, Jerry Brown used to use that language. Jennifer Fletcher?
Yeah, it's just the idea that we're all connected. And again, it speaks a little bit to the anti-politics perspective. Just that instead of looking at, you know, very individual property lines, it's just one connected Earth, and we're all on it together.
Well, even though he's so connected to the Bay Area, despite not living here, he's so connected to geodesic domes, even though he was not, contrary to what many people think, the one who gave us geodesic domes. I mean, he designed them, but they didn't necessarily come out of his skull, did they?
He
wasn't a founder of. I don't think he was the founder of the geodesic.
There's debatable. Even some some debate there, but he definitely is credited with
popularizing.
Yeah. Oh no, definitely popularized them. What did he hope would happen with geodesic domes? Do we know what his hopes or his aspirations were ultimately?
Well, he felt like the dome. It was part of his design revolution because the dome is the most efficient way there is to enclose space, and so he thought if we're all living in domes, we'll use so much less resources, there'll be enough to go around. And I think he had high hopes with the dome.
There's still some around here, actually. I mean, you go up to up north.
The UC Davis dome.
That's right.
Community.
Dome. There's one at UC Davis, but I was thinking of one closer in, near Mendocino.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
What do you think Fuller should be most remembered for, each of you? I mean, we've kind of talked around it, but I mean, let's get concrete here, can we?
It's a big question. You go first, Jennifer.
There's so many things that he could be remembered for, but I think that
he rise to the top.
The kind of looking at designed informed by real time issues, it's just interesting to me that there is this hope that design might affect social change. And that's a very small kind of view of Fuller, but that is one that is of interest.
It's very significant, though. Yeah, Sam, you want to add something?
I think the same. Just as a person who believed passionately and profoundly that through design we could make a better world, and certainly a sort of mid 20th century fantastic character who advocated tirelessly on behalf of those ideas.
We're talking about visionary inventor Buckminster Fuller, who never lived in the Bay Area, but there's evidence of his influence, and it can be found in many innovative and environmentally conscious projects in the Bay Area. San Francisco MoMA's new architecture and design exhibition, The Utopian Impulse, Buckminster Fuller in the Bay Area, explores Fuller's work, as well as a diverse set of local projects, from tent design to a sailboat made from plastic water bottles that drew inspiration from the work of Buckminster Fuller. And that exhibit is going on really through July, till the end of July, July 27th. Again, feel free to join the program. Lines are full, but when one becomes available, the toll-free number is 866-733-6786. A lot of people remember Bucky Fuller. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any question or comment on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. And you're getting pretty good crowds there, aren't you, Jennifer?
Yes, especially yesterday. It was Free Tuesday, and it was packed.
And it was May Day. Okay.
Yes.
We'll continue, and we'll take your calls and hear from you when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about visionary inventor Buckminster Fuller, and the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art is exhibiting Well, Fuller's work, Architecture, Design Exhibition, The Utopian Impulse, Buckminster Fuller and the Bay Area, exploring his work and really his influence on the Bay Area. Jennifer Fletcher is with us. She's Assistant Curator of Architecture and Design and Acting Head of the Department of the San Francisco Museum of Art, and curated The Utopian Impulse. Sam Green, filmmaker, his film The Love Song of Our Buckminster Fuller is playing as part of the San Francisco MoMA exhibit on Fuller, and he also has a display up as well of a relationship in 12 fragments. And looking at some of the web comments that are coming in, Kitty says, I went to the exhibit yesterday. It was great. Definitely my favorite out of everything currently at the San Francisco MoMA. We don't want to get all kinds of rivalries going on here, but that's
Kitty.
What she says. That's what Kitty says. She says, I finally know who designed the federal building near my house, though not his most impressive work, and I love his crank-charging laptop for children in third-world countries. Andy writes... Yeah, the federal building was not his. Let's get that.
Right, I mean, right. No, it was by Morphosis.
That. Right.
But Morphosis has stated, you know, that looking at Fuller and the idea of an informed or responsive architecture was of interest in this exhibition.
So, and the same with the laptop. That was not...
No, that was Yves Bihar, Fuse Project.
So just, we're talking about influence here, and it's an influence that's very wide. 30 years ago, Andy writes, I attended a three-hour lecture by Bucky at CSU Chico. I was a 20-year-old college student. The lecture was the single best learning experience of my undergraduate education. I'm eager to see the SF MoMA exhibit. And Sam, you were talking about the fact that Bucky Fuller used to send out how many pages when he was giving talks?
He would send out a 67-page bio to people.
And there's another talk of his that's on YouTube now. Which one is that?
It's the first recorded talk I could find in the Bay Area. He talked to a philosophy class at San Quentin in 1952, and the audio of that is on YouTube, and it's fantastic. And like a lot of things from his archive, it's a little bit of a mystery what the circumstances were. There was a philosophy class at San Quentin, and I don't know a lot more than that about it, but there's this recording, and it's really interesting.
Here's Jeff, who writes, I'm sitting below my print of the Dymaxion Air Ocean World Map. Does the SF MoMA have a Dymaxion car at the exhibit?
No.
Alas.
But just the drawings for the car.
Let's bring our callers in. Ron, you're first up. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. I am interested in his Buckminster's stay at San Jose State. He was guest lecturer when I was a student there, and there was a lot of talk about the geodesic dome. And I, unfortunately, being a young student, thought, what a strange-looking building. And I didn't attend any of his lectures just because I thought he was an off-the-wall person, but now I'm matured and...
And you're off the wall, too?
Well, I suppose so. But I would like to see the exhibit and learn more about him. And I'd like to know what he did, actually, at San Jose when I was there.
Yeah, Sam, you're nodding your head.
Yeah. He did a sort of residency at San Jose University, which I think may have been called San Jose
State College. It was San Jose State College then. Yeah.
And it was 1966, and he was there for several months and gave a number of lectures. And one interesting thing that came out of that is one of the people who went to one of his lectures was Stuart Brand. And Stuart Brand, in the video installation, I did an interview with Fred Turner, who tells this story. Stuart Brand was so inspired, a little chemically inspired, that night after seeing the talk. He went up onto his roof and thought to himself, why haven't we seen a picture of the whole Earth yet? You know, he was looking out and over the city, and that's where he got the inspiration. He later started this campaign to get a picture of the whole Earth released by NASA, because nobody had seen the whole Earth at that point, 1966. So he was inspired by Fuller, launched this campaign to get a picture. They finally released a picture, and that became the cover of the Whole Earth catalog. So that came out of San Jose State in 1966.
And Ron, thank you for your call, and we'll go to another caller. Frank, that's you. Join us, please.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Thanks for the show. I remember being in high school when I saw the first I don't know if it was then when I saw the first Whole Earth catalog, but the geodesic dome, and I thought by the time I was able to buy a house that they'd be all over. And it's just amazing. I mean, I know people are greedy, but, you know, it's just almost impossible to build what you want. And it's been proven how much stronger these structures are. There's a guy who owns a bunch of land in Arizona, and he's built all these alternative structures in 7 years in the courts just to get these things go through. And it boggles the mind. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And if either of you want to respond to that,
well, there is an aspect of the exhibition that looks at the kind of the hope for the geodesic dome. We looked at the kind of early adopters of the dome through military use, which would quickly shelter like a helicopter or act as a radar, through more commercial uses like the Union car tank dome in Louisiana, and then into more leisure domes. There's the O dome that you could have as a second home. And then there seemed to be this move away from dome living. There were some publications that cited domes as uncomfortable or leaking. And it was interesting to trace that, I think, within the archives that you could see this. The domes held this great hope at one point of being an alternative to the rectilinear kind of square international style.
I think we have a caller on the line here who actually worked on a project of a geodesic dome. Chris, that you?
Yeah, that's me. Hi, from San Francisco. And I worked on a project called Old Man River, which was a domed city project in East St. Louis, Illinois. I was 20 years old at the time being a student at Washington University. And I must say, sitting through a 3-hour lecture, listening to him talk about what the Midwest was all about, 3.5 hours, was just bizarre in a way. I thought, what a visionary, and I hope someday to understand him. And at 8-6, now living in San Francisco, I think I got it. It took a while. And one last comment about practical problems or issues with the geodesic dome. Our professor, who was an associate of Fuller's, was a house guest in his geodesic dome house in Southern Illinois University. And the one thing he said was that listening to somebody to go to the bathroom in the geodesic dome was worthy of comment. The noise echoed like crazy. And that's it.
All right. Thank you. A memorable comment, to be sure. We're going to get another caller on. Gordon from Campbell, join us. Hi.
Hi, Michael. Great program again. Thanks. I was one of that original batch of students at San Jose State in 1968 when Bucky came through. Nearly stopped my entire education because it was so relevant. But Bucky's greatest legacy is whole systems design. That is thinking from the universal back to the specific. And one of the things that Bucky really understood was that that's the natural process of young people. They look at the big picture, and then when they have to deal with all the local politicking and all the rest of it, they're very frustrated. But they are inherently designed as organisms to look at it from the big picture down.
The psychologists talk about this as gestalt, and he was clearly influenced by that kind of thinking, by Kafka, not Franz Kafka, Kofka, the gestalt psychologist.
Exactly. And Fuller was the first one that made the logic of that apparent to me when he said the reason is that you cannot understand synergies from the lower level. Synergies bring about an unexpected occurrence, and that can only be understood looking back at it or out back into it. And Fuller was very fond of saying that mankind backs into its future. So the good news is, even though we develop weaponry, which was another one of his terms, of it is that we can ultimately get to livingry.
Okay. Thanks for those comments, Gordon. Really good. Yeah, good to hear from you.
Very well said.
Yes, thank you, Gordon.
And you think about, I mean, Fuller will kind of endure, won't he? I mean, he'll live on. Just from what we're hearing from listeners now, but I mean, there's a whole younger generation that's going to have to capture him again.
Yeah. Yeah. But he was smart in creating his archive. He will continue to live through his archive. He made sure of that.
Did he go into his specifics about his toilet stuff or any? I mean, there's so much in that archive, right? I mean, in terms of daily habits and the quotidian. And
probably find some stuff like that.
I think so.
There is a bathroom in the exhibition.
Oh, there is. That's right.
Yeah.
Tim joining us next. Tim, you're on.
Oh, hey, guys. I'm a general contractor in the North Bay, and I've had the pleasure or displeasure of having to repair and work on domes most of my building career, and they are kind of a nightmare. they have a real hard time getting effective, cost-effective ceiling, weatherproofing, rather, and sound insulation, of course, that was already mentioned, and you know, just ergonomically, you have to really kind of dice them up and try to make them work for functionality. And the biggest thing is they're very expensive to execute.
Yeah, I was going to say, the cost is a big factor, Tim, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. They're not conventional. So if you're pretty much, you know, it's a labor of love if you want to build one of these things, and you get expect to spend, you know, a good proportion more than conventional construction. Anyway, that's all.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I actually really like the interior space and what can be done with them, but they, as far as cost effectiveness, not so much.
Well, thanks, Tim. Good to hear from you. Again, we're talking with Jennifer Fletcher from San Francisco MoMA and Sam Green, filmmaker, the love song of R. Buckminster Fuller, which premiered at the San Francisco International Film Festival last night and is an installation on Fuller at the SF MoMA exhibit. Let's go to more of your calls, and we'll go to Oakland. Brian, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Michael. I lived across the street from Bucky while I was an undergraduate at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, and got to be close friends with his. There's so much information coming across the line here, but I will say one thing that most people don't know. I work for CBS News on the evening news with Walter Cronkite. And in 1969, when we covered the moon landing, Walter had me with my one big break in journalism, and unfortunately it didn't work out, I was sitting next to Walter just off camera, and Bucky was sitting next to me, and in case Armstrong crashed, which he almost did, Cronkite was going to bring on Bucky, because Bucky was a great believer in, one step forward, one step backward, but you have to keep at it. You just have to keep at it. He was a very tenacious person as an individual, and the moon landing was such a dangerous procedure, and Bucky could talk for three and a half hours straight. All his talks, he gave he was in residence in Carbondale, and all he had to do was give a talk once every quarter, and he could just get up for three and a half hours with no slides, no pauses,
Brian.
Yeah, right. He just continuously talked, and it was fascinating. It was just like he kept everybody just absolutely. He would mesmerize you. He had so much information, and I remember one of the things he constantly talked about was how absurd it was to build suburban houses on one story. Bucky said, if you can't build domes, and he was fully aware of the problems of domes, he thought they should be mass-produced, not one-off builder. But he said, if you can't build a dome, the next best way to enclose space with the minimum outside surface area was to build cubicle housing. But he drove a Citroen, a DS21 or ID21, I can't remember the nomenclature, but he was a very unusual person. He never attended any faculty parties, and the faculty at SIU deeply resented him because they wanted him to come to all their parties. He wasn't a joiner. He wasn't a politician. What I didn't know at the time was that he privately cured himself or at least controlled himself with his alcoholism. He just stopped drinking, and one of the ways that he controlled it was not to hang out with people who drank.
Well, you know, I'm sorry, Brian, but and this is not a plug or anything. As many listeners know, I wrote a book called Off Mic many years ago that Stanford Press published, and there's a story in there about Southern Illinois University, because I went there for a job opportunity. Actually, was given, offered a job there, and people said there was nothing to do there but drink. I mean, that was the general wisdom about, you know, it was one of the things that made me decide this is not a place for me. But, you know, you were privileged to know him. Obviously, you realize that, yeah.
Yeah, I was so privileged. I had Armstrong, I don't know what delay, 19, 17 seconds, something like that, with fuel left there. Otherwise, he would have gone off into history as a, you know, the splat on the moon. And then Bookie would have come on, and that didn't work out. I'm truly sad that the mass media in America, the media, really never. Because he could just talk and talk, as I'm probably doing right now.
You picked up the habit from him.
His mind just ranged from subject to subject. He's a brilliant mathematician, and his one probably great credit to the with the geodesic dome was that he mathematically formularized how to build a dome. And like I said, he didn't really believe in one-off domes. He thought they should be mass-produced. He wanted to convert all the aircraft factories after World War II.
Brian, we got to get you on for a special hour to talk about Bucky Fuller just by yourself. And by the way, I'm sorry you didn't get that break with CBS, but I thank you for joining us. I want to get some more callers on. I'm actually getting a web comment. Listener writes, I did not see reference to buckyballs, the class of chemicals, particularly Buckminster Fullerene, discovered after his death. Did I miss them?
No. This was an exhibition that looked at the, it's a design exhibition. So we didn't go into all aspects of Fuller.
Another listener, Deb, says, Bucky had a great sense of humor. He ended a weekend seminar with Michael Toms by having us all sing with him. The song was Dome, Dome on the Range. Mm-hmm. Ooh, okay. Another web comment. Can you talk about the lowest point of Bucky's life and how he reinvented himself from near suicidal to becoming a visionary? I think we could learn from him a lot about reinventing ourselves in difficult times.
Yeah, he, in the 20s, as a young man, he got married, he had a daughter, and his daughter died at age 4 of spinal meningitis. And it was a huge tragedy for himself and his wife. And around the same, a little while later, he had gone into business with his father-in-law, and the business failed. And so he found himself in the late 20s, broke.
This, excuse me, was why there were a lot of analogies to Mark Twain, whose daughter died, who was an inventor and lost in business.
So he was really at rock bottom, and he went to the he lived in Chicago. He went to the shores of Lake Michigan. He was going to throw himself in. He was going to kill himself. And apparently, the story goes, he had some kind of mystical experience on the shore of Lake Michigan, and a voice told him to dedicate himself to humanity instead of killing himself. And he decided right then and there to set off on this 50-year experiment to see if one person could change the world. And, you know, some of that might be a little bit of self-mythology, but it really is true. From that point on, he was pretty monomaniacally focused on this goal of making the world a better place. So it's a pretty inspiring story.
It's an uplifting story.
Yeah. And he told it many times.
He probably has made the world a better place in many respects.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Peter joins us next. Peter, thanks for waiting. Join us, please.
Hi, Michael. You're so welcome. This is such a delightful show. You know, in my work for World Peace, I often use the phrase, the challenge of peace. And a quotation from Buckminster Fuller that's cited by the Institute, the Buckminster Fuller Institute on one of their brochures, is such a challenge to every individual for their own personal responsibility to world peace. It goes like this. If the success or failure of this planet and of human beings depended on how I am and what I do, how would I be? What would I do? And in looking that up, I saw another one. Apparently, it has to be a little better sourced. All of humanity now has the option to make it successfully and sustainably by virtue of our having minds, discovering principles, and being able to employ these principles to do more with less.
Right, thank you, Peter, for those. When you think about things like visualize world peace, and I'm not talking about the bumper sticker, visualize world P-E-A-S, you think about Bucky Fuller. I mean, there was a kind of sense of wanting humanity to all be involved. In fact, the sense of, it's kind of almost an existential sense of, you are responsible for everybody else in terms of your behavior. He really believed that.
Yeah.
He had this term, trim tab, that he used on himself, but he also especially when we were looking at how many times he came to the Bay Area and that he talked to so many different audiences. It wasn't, you know, that he was trying to work within one field or one community, but he talked to the hippies in Golden Gate Park. He talked to Stanford, NASA, prisoners at San Quentin. And just I think that this notion of Trim Tab being one little person within and speaking to one individual within a larger field, that within your own fields and disciplines, you would make a larger change.
And you're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our next caller is Roger. Welcome, Roger.
Thanks. My story is I was at the University of Pennsylvania in 1974, graduate school design, at a lecture program with various professors and outside folks. And Bucky was one of the speakers. And the thing that I remember from that lecture series was he said, everything in the world is in this room right now if we just had receptors to pick it up. And nobody had any idea what he was talking about at the time, but when you think about Google and YouTube and the net, there's a prediction that came true.
And sensors.
I'm sorry?
And sensors, I was thinking of, too.
Yeah.
I'm not people who censor. I mean censors. Thank you for that memory, Roger. And we'll go to another caller. Stephen, that's you.
Hi. I was curious if Mr. Fuller might have had any other creative outlets besides design, like, say, Leonardo with painting, music, et cetera, other than his actual engineering feats.
Do we know?
We know he wrote poetry.
Yeah, he was a great. He wrote a lot of books, and
I've read some of his poetry. It's not all that.
It was an interesting.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it certainly had a lot of creative energy in that area. And then he did that art project towards the end of his life. I can't remember the name of it exactly.
I'm not remembering it.
Well, thank you for the question. A lot of people knew Bucky Fuller. Maybe somebody can tell us about some easels that may be out there that have been put away in a closet. Lisa joins us next. Lisa, hi.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because I was a resident of a community of domes at UC Davis, and they lived in Baggins End. There were 14 domes that were built and designed by students who were interested in creating less expensive housing options on campus. And so we were very much channeling the spirit of Bucky in the sense that, you know, we were open to new designs. They were low cost, and you know, they looked like half of an eggshell. They had a fiberglass shell with polyurethane foam and insulation, and there were two people per dome. We raised chickens and did organic gardening, but it was very much of a design and a lifestyle that's where we felt close to him.
Very good. Thank you so much for giving that to us and letting us know about this. And I'm grabbing an email here that just came in. Catalina brought in. Jonathan writes, I just wanted to add that when I heard him speak 34 years ago in Amherst, Massachusetts, he started by telling us that he was almost completely blind. And when they went to creating houses at school with toothpicks and peas, he made a triangular shape. He was influenced strongly by not being influenced by his sight. Go to another caller, and that's you. Gil, hi.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for this. I encountered Bucky first out of the Whole Earth catalog back in 1971, and in 1972 spent a month with his World Game workshop in Carbondale, Illinois, a month-long design charrette for the planet, looking comprehensively, as everything he did was, at how do we get a planet that works for 100% of humanity in the shortest possible time through spontaneous cooperation, without ecological offense or the disadvantage of anyone. That was the challenge he posed to us. And we had teams looking at every area from energy and food to housing and healthcare, transportation, and several others. It was a profound learning experience, worth far more than 4 years of college. And the takeaway that made it so profound was that it was very clear from taking that comprehensive whole systems approach and diving deep into the data that we actually can do it, you know, that there's actually no physical barrier to human success on the planet. And that formative experience, but 40 years ago, has fed my work in sustainability and that of a lot of other people in this field. Very seminal and potent even today.
Thank you so much, Gil. You know, I mentioned sensors before, Jennifer. The Future City Club has those.
The Future Cities Lab, yes.
That's in the display. I mean, in the exhibit, yeah.
Yes, yes. Just the idea of a responsive architecture. So this is a model that's on display in the exhibit that imagines a kind of floating park off of the Embarcadero that is completely – it has these kind of a responsive trellis that can harvest water from the air, from fog and from rain, but also act as a shade device as well. And then the whole park is completely hydrated and sustaining. So it's a conceptual proposal, but it's certainly an interesting one.
A listener named Nani who writes, in 1971, my CO commune piled in the van and drove to Aspen to see that's Colorado, to see Bucky. I was 17 and only knew that we were devotees if the magical cosmic feel of the man and the night. Are you aware of Clark Richard and the original American commune drop city in southern Colorado? It was all geodesic domes and artists inspired by Bucky.
Yeah, drop city is really interesting. They made domes out of car hoods. Mm-hmm. They would get junk cars and take the hoods and weld them all together to make these really incredibly weird-looking domes. And corresponded with Fuller. There's correspondence in his archive between Drop City and him.
I think it received a Fuller Award.
Yeah,
right?
He gave them an award.
Yes.
The Fuller Award. Here's John from Napa who writes, did they use material from D.W. Jacobs' one-man show at the Artaud Project in 2003? It was an amazing show.
No, we didn't in the exhibit, no.
No. Okay, I just wanted to get that on
we
record.
Knew about it.
Yeah, and that was a great show.
Yeah.
It was also influenced by Fuller?
This was his monologues reenacting Fuller.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was another show that because we're talking about Bay Area influence. But decided to exclude it because...
Oh, because it wasn't emphasizing design necessarily. It was more a biographical portrait of theatrical performance.
Should know this, but thank you for informing me and educating me. It's been a really educational hour. I mean, we've certainly learned a lot about Bucky Fuller, who he was, what he was. Thanks to you, our callers and listeners, for joining in this. And thanks to Sam Green, filmmaker who's here with us. His film, again, is The Love Song of Our Buckminster Fuller, which premiered at the San Francisco International Film Festival last night and is an installation at the exhibit at the San Francisco MoMA. Jennifer Fletcher is the assistant curator of architecture and design, acting head of the department at the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and curated The Utopian Impulse, Buckminster Fuller in the Bay Area, playing, exhibiting, showing, displaying right up through July 29th. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll. And by the way, you can continue this conversation about Bucky Fuller on our website or on our Facebook page, kqed.org/forum. And click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. Thanks to our producers, Judy Campbell and Christina Russo. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.